Okay, we are really lucky today to be interviewing the wonderful Ponsel.
Yay, thank you.
Welcome to the South Australian Playwrights Theatre podcast. We've been in hiatus for a little while, but we're about to go back into the full production of some staged readings at the Holden Street Theatre. So I'm really excited.
Yeah.
Ponsel, tell me about yourself.
Well, I am a freelance actor and just overall artist, as you would say. Like, I write, I do poetry, and yeah, just like pretty much anything that has to do with art, except for drawing, because I can't draw to help.
Can't draw anything.
Not even a stick figure.
Not a stick man.
Like, my stick man will break while I draw him. Like, that's how bad it is. My brother got all those genes, but singing, you bring it, dancing, I got you. You know, writing, filmmaking, just behind the scenes, period. Even presenting, because I did a talk show about a couple of years ago, actually, a live talk show.
You were the presenter of the talk
show. Yeah, I was. I was one of three at first. I was the only female on the cast. So it was two men and one female.
And what was the talk show called?
It was called Oprah Next Level. No, it was called the RNF talk show, but now it's called Smart TV.
Okay.
So it's run by like the pioneers basically of the Liberian community in Adelaide.
Okay,
They've been working at it for a couple of years now, but then like they changed the name because of the old hosts are no longer there.
Okay.
But I've always been there from like the grassroots, because I remember meeting the people who actually started it at a dinner party, and we're talking about it before they developed it.
Okay.
And they're like, oh, you should be part of it. And I was like, definitely. But I always feel like sometimes I feel like people are always selling you a dream. Like, oh, we should do this. So I was like,
industry talk.
Pretty much that whole, like selling you a dream. Like, we're going to do this. And you're like, So I wasn't buying their story.
Yeah.
But I think 6 months later, they called me. No, actually they didn't call me. They did an audition call on Facebook. And I was like, why are you guys doing an audition call for a host when you already know it's me?
Yeah.
So my friend, who was the one who had actually introduced me to, was telling me like, no, we actually have a proper producer now. So you have to audition and kind of get the part. And then I did the audition, smack bang, on the day.
And your style as a presenter, you know, were you like investigative journalist style, like, you know, 60 Minutes? Would you try and, you know, make people
grill
uncomfortable,
people.
Grill them?
Nah, never that. More so it was to push the conversation, because it was a live Facebook show.
It was
mainly important to make sure that the audience is engaged, but as well as the host. Sometimes, you know, you have to ask the questions that the guest themselves won't even think they can answer. We'd speak about things like, you know, gambling, we spoke about addiction, we spoke about teenage pregnancy, both in the African,
with a focus on the African
community. In the African community, because the main necessity for it was that people should be educated in the African community. Mm. You know, we talked about Centrelink. We talked about, should people rely on Centrelink, the different things of like welfare, period.
Yeah.
If it's a good thing, if it helps. And it was very interesting to hear the kind of conversations that people had about it. And even just dating, like just what dating is and how we have evolved, like from the African perspective, not even African perspective, but like how our parents used to basically court, and then how we come into this world and we're like, how you doing? So it was really good.
Did you deal with any of the kind of misconceptions about the African Australian community at all, or was it mainly about the way they were thinking and feeling?
No, I think we did have a lot of, like, you know, because some of our audience was actually in America.
Oh, okay.
So like we'd have people who would actually like literally set their alarms to make sure that when we're on, they would actually be on.
And these were Americans.
American Liberians. Yeah. So they would So they were into, like, we had Liberian artists actually come from Liberia and launch their song in, like, on our show and things like that. And
it's sort of aimed at the Liberian diaspora.
It was definitely aimed at that. But because I'm South African, so it was, I brought a very different mix in a weird way, because at first, obviously, you know, it's like, what's this girl going to tell us about her community? But then it's also like, oh, and also, number one, I was like 19. So I was like 19, 18. So around that time, obviously, it's like, oh, this little girl, what's she going to tell us? And then afterwards, they're like, oh, okay, she actually got some sense. So it was a bit...
Well, obviously, you got to have an open mind. And you got to listen to people and see where they're coming from.
Definitely, definitely.
But the Liberian community, which is a very good segue into the play that we will be doing a staged reading of, one of the plays at Holden Street Theatre called Monrovia.
Which I'm excited about.
Yes, and you are playing the role of...
Jasmine,
who is the slave wife, eventual leader of this new African country, Liberia, it's former American colony.
Which is very, like, very crazy, actually, the different, the history behind it, but yeah, sorry.
Well, things go full circle. I mean, the idea of Africans going back to Africa or African Americans going back to Africa and then going to Liberia and then going back to America it's around and around and around.
And the crazy thing is I didn't even know about that history before working with the Liberian people. So, like, I, like, you know, a lot of times we'd always think, like, because you're an African, you would know so much history and knowledge about other African countries.
Well, it is often just simply regarded as a kind of homogenous unit of people, which is completely wrong, of course.
Very.
It's extraordinary diversity of people.
It is. And, you know, the crazy thing about that is, like, when I found out, because my friend was telling me, like, oh, have you done the history of Liberia? And obviously, because I was doing the talk show and winging it at the time, I was just winging it on the knowledge that I knew, you know, like, just general knowledge. But when I found out that, wait, there's like a whole history with America and them coming back and them being the ones who are to enslave their own people.
Indeed.
And, you know, it's a very crazy,
But I think what attracted me to the story, to begin writing the story, was the idea of this missionary society that was wanting to repatriate Africans to their homeland, in inverted commas.
Exactly.
And they were in league with the plantation owners who didn't want them free. And that if they were going to be free after the Civil War, they wanted them out. So it was there's so much complexity
there is
toward that kind of patronizing attitude towards another sort of fringe dwellers of society.
Definitely. And I mean, it's also so crazy, like, for example, like and I often used to ask myself this, like, how do African Americans feel when they go to Africa? Because, you know, like, one thing that makes me understand the cry of Aboriginal people is the loss of culture, throughout time, and loss of language, loss of connection to your heritage. So for me as a South African, at least I know that, you know, back home, like we were talking earlier, we can drink Mpombo tea, we can do all these little things of my culture that make me feel like I'm South African. So now think about, like, Liberians leaving and going abroad and then becoming African Americans, not just Africans, and then coming back and being Africans.
Yeah.
You know, that whole power trip.
The identity morphs and borrows from other cultures and ethnicities. I think South Africa is a really interesting examples of a multiplicity of cultures and languages and religions that need to somehow cooperate
and coexist.
And I always wondered, with urbanization and so-called, you know, modernization, do these things get enhanced, and do they create a hybrid culture or do they remain separate?
I feel like they like you said, they enhance. Do you know what I mean? Like, because I feel like we were talking generations and generations of, like, blended cultures, you know, generations and generations of blended traditions, generations and generations of just black people being compacted into one and being seen as that. So now they have no choice but to be that. Do you know what I mean? Like, like how we speak and how we say, I can understand somebody who speaks Xhosa, I can understand somebody who speaks Zulu. I can. That's not my mother tongue at the time. But the fact that I had the liberty of that comes from that whole, like, enhanced, you know,
sense of identity cultures that identify with as Africans.
As Africans, exactly.
Would you include the Afrikaners in that
that's the
collection
thing, I can't.
Of people?
You know, I've always tried to, and it's, I know it sounds...
Which is what one wants with the Rainbow Nation, of
course. Yeah, because, know? I mean, of course, like, ek praat Afrikaans, ek verstaan Afrikaans, but, like, even me talking or understanding Afrikaans, I still have that missing piece of like, how do I call you an original African? Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's why I don't blame people for not calling me an Australian. I'm like, I'm cool. I already got my roots.
Well, unless you're Indigenous,
exactly,
you all came from somewhere else.
Exactly. And then how do you feel proud to be like, oh, I'm Australian? Like, it's like, you know, from the roots of you, yes, we're Australian. Yes, we're born here. Yes, we have the culture of Australia. But from the core roots of it, who are you? Do you know what I mean? That identity of like who...
It goes across place as well. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there might be Afrikaners who would argue, well, we came up from the south the same way Shaka Zulu was coming down from the north and we met and, you know, who knows? I don't know. I'm not a historian. But
and that's crazy that you say that, because a lot of people would be like, oh, no, like, you know, before England came to South Africa, the Boers and the Zulus were living fine in segregation. Uh-huh, you know what I mean? Yeah. So you can't tell us that we're not South Africans. We have 4 or 5 generations of being here. But it's like, do you have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like all these generations from like the core? Do you know what I mean? Like from the core of who you are, where are your ancestors from?
Yes.
And it's like, okay, we all from Africa because, you know, as the world works, like, you know, we all spread out or whatever. But it's like at the core of culture. Where are you from?
And that is a form of identity. Mm. But I guess another form of identity is a community that comes together and learns from each other is another mixed kind of thing as well. But again, going back to Liberia, when we had the kind of Monrovia established, named, of course, after President Monroe of the United States, and then those people then turned around and sort of oppressed the locals at the same time.
And I didn't understand that.
Well... Nor do I fully. I wasn't there. But through
no way. I swear I saw you in a textbook.
But through research, I found that with the roots of the slavery, it started in the inland with small wars, small conflicts, and slavery. There was quite a different concept because it was basically, all right, well, we'll take your people, but then eventually they become integrated and equal with our people, as opposed to sticking them in a ship and making them cut sugarcane till they die, which is obviously a far more horrible fate. So there's slavery and then there's slavery. But it's not all the same.
There's slavery and there's... But I feel like there's... like, for example, there's so many different kinds of slavery. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, just because... It's like just because I'm in jail in, like, a 5-star hotel... And I can't leave, right? And I've got room service, but I can't
leave.
Sounds
amazing.
I was like, sounds like my dream.
Who was that? There was some entrepreneur who got sort of home imprisonment in a 5-star hotel.
Really?
Yeah, just, you know, had room service.
But at the same time, the same person would hate that notion after a while because of the fact that you're locked and you're chained and
your freedom is
curtailed. It's taken from you.
What about Julian Assange? Do you think he, you know, the WikiLeaks guy? I mean, he was in the Ecuadorian embassy for like 6 years he didn't clean the toilet or anything until they chucked him out. But yeah, anyway, I've diverted. Let's leave him alone. He's got enough attention.
Trust.
Back to your definition of slavery.
Yeah, so going from like 5-star hotel. No, okay, no, not 5-star. Let's say 2-star. Do you know what I mean? Like one-star slave hotel. You know?
Yes.
And then you go from like a slave that's kept in the gutter, kept in the basement, not fed, not nothing, right? Both people have something in common. They are constricted of their freedom. They don't have the freedom to choose to do or to have the will that they would want to. It's just that one is given the idea that this is luxury, and the other one is already understands the fact that I am a slave. Do you understand what I mean? So it's like sometimes people were slaves without even knowing they were slaves. And that's why even, who's this? I think, I can't believe I'm forgetting. I think it's Harriet Tubman, like the lady who freed the slaves in America. She said something along the lines of, I would have freed thousands of more slaves if they knew they were slaves.
I see.
So it's like so many, when you think about it from like our perspective or like from the Liberia perspective, it's like, okay, these people came and of course there were the locals who were there and hadn't been taken out and put into slavery. But when they came back, the people who had come back from America and had that slave mentality and now had been given the mentality of we're superior than the locals, they don't understand. They felt like that was freedom, not understanding that that's not freedom. That's just another form of jail in their mind. you know what I mean? They gave them freedom through actual hand, you know, oh, you can walk, you can go here. Mm. But in your mind, you still have that mentality of massa.
Well, indeed, mm-hmm. mental slavery or putting yourself in the position of someone who is disempowered is how real power often is enacted, particularly in terms of religion.
And I was just about to say that. Same thing as, like, you know, like, I'm a Christian, but, like, I completely understand how Christianity was used as that number one, like, spiraling tool of, like, oh, like, we're going to... I even know the scriptures now that I know that people were using back then. Because there's a scripture in the Bible that says... this is in Colossians, you know, slaves, obey your masters, wives, obey your husband, children, obey your fathers.
It's a hierarchy.
You know, it's a hierarchy of, like, okay, kids, obey mom and dad, wife, obey your husband, slave, obey your master, right? But the intent of the whole scripture or the context of it was just a matter of, like, if you have, for example, if I'm at work and I have a boss or whatever authority is supposed to be above me, and I have a boss, just make sure that you're doing the job that you're supposed to be doing. Do you know what I mean? But then what the slave drivers were doing were like, Jesus said, you need to listen to me or else I'm going to shoot you. Your reward will come in heaven. So now people are having this mentality of, like, okay, if I run, if I try to find a way to get myself out of this, God is going to be the one to punish me, not the slave driver. You know what I mean? This guy's gun is less scary than what God will give me, because God did this in the Bible to this person, and he did this. And obviously they would bring stories of fear and torment. What's the number one way? Hell is the biggest,
you're going to go to... Especially the carrot.
Exactly. And it's like, oh, no, you're going to go to hell if you don't do this. So a lot of people... But at the same time is that the religion aspect of it gives you hope, because now... you have the hope of a better life, not in this life, but in another life.
Yeah, and it opens up a whole can of worms in terms of mental health as well. You know, back then, when you got nothing, when you got nothing, but you got Jesus, you got something.
You've got something.
It doesn't matter whether it exists or not. Exactly. It's something to hold on to.
And people knowing that like, there's this faith base and this hope. And that's why I love the African spirit, is that the resilience, the fact of, like, oh, we can be resilient because we know something's going to come for us. Something's going to come for us. God's going to hear 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 us. And that cry of, like, God's going to hear us over time. But understanding that these people are actually taking that, being like, God's not going to hear you. Don't worry, but I'm still going to beat you up. God's going to hear you, but don't worry. I still need those, like, 5 ounces of, like, cotton. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they're not going to pick themselves.
And of course, not every, Westerner agreed or believed in slavery. Mm. And there were many, many people trying to stop slavery. And in fact, your average person, come the late 1700s and 1800s, found it abhorrent. And there's many, many tracts written about the way it shouldn't happen. But unfortunately, I mean, I did some research into Haiti and Saint Domingo, which was the Middle East of the 1700s. It produced all the sugar, all the coffee, all the luxury goods, but it was worth millions to France and Spain, and in fact produced more money than all of the 13 colonies of the United States.
No way.
It was more capital came out of Haiti than all of the United States.
No
it's
way.
Unbelievable, back in 1750 to 1800, because of the sugar, which and is an bet. Interesting sort of theme that we're discussing running through Monrovia, is the idea of sugar. This intense energy, this refined energy that then becomes extraordinarily
valuable.
That people
didn't even know about, like, that it could, you know, especially when I was reading, part of the script, and I was like, that's so crazy that we never understand the power of little minute things like sugar, like, like cotton. Like, I went to a market the other day, and they had cotton, and I didn't know that cotton grows on trees. So I was like, I just thought bushes per se, but I didn't even know that. I was just like, I just thought cotton just came out of somewhere. I don't know. Like, I really don't
it
know
fell
what
from
I
the sky
honestly or... like, it could be manna for all I know.
the little cotton sheep.
Literally, like, you know, God just has a particular side when he's like, all right, catch, you know, I was thinking. But I went to like a market, and this lady was like selling cotton actual trees, like and I was like, oh, no way, like, that's so crazy, like, I didn't understand the power of, like, how it came to that, like, the power of cotton. When I looked at it, I was like, it's just a plant, like, it's just a little plant, but you don't understand the power of it
well, it's a commodity that is in demand.
Mm.
And if you think that most clothes back in the day were made of cotton,
mm-hmm.
and if you control that commodity and people want that commodity,
you're...
people need to be clothed.
Yeah.
Therefore, you have the power.
Mm-hmm.
People need petroleum,
mm-hmm.
and that is in the hands of OPEC countries, you know, a sort of declared monopoly mm-hmm. on it. And it's always interesting, these things that are needed, like oil, cotton, mm-hmm. sugar,
mm.
they are a source of misery for so many other people.
So many people.
Yeah. Particularly like Nigeria, where oil, once that was extracted from Nigeria, it's just guaranteed misery for the people of Biafra.
And just generally, just even just like so many countries where like oil, minerals, all these things that were like extracted out. And the crazy thing is that most of the countries where these things were taken from didn't understand the value of it until it was already like...
Indeed. I mean, the other corporations were set up to profit from those commodities.
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, sugarcane, it was labor intensive, but they needed to replenish the slaves in order to make it profitable.
Mm.
And then you had this system. That's why I was talking about the good people so-called good people who didn't believe in slavery
mm-hmm.
Didn't have to see it, but would still benefit from the economic benefits, you know.
That's so crazy because it goes back, sorry to cut you, but it goes back to like how we always talk about like, you know, not everybody, like, you know, people are like, not everybody's racist, not everybody. It's like, yeah, I completely understand that. Of course, not everybody's racist. Like, we're not stupid. Like, but people, it's the lack of, like how we said last time, the lack of conversation about it and the lack of acknowledging of the generational of power.
Mm.
It's like, you may not be a for this, but you being able to know that you are, you are benefiting from this, but you're still somewhere, you know what I mean?
Yes, and therein lies the complexity of the world in terms of politics and community.
Everything.
That we hide.
Literally.
We hide in our silos mm-hmm. and we don't want to see the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, one can't. When where does one point the finger of blame?
Mm.
And how, therefore, do you rectify that? It is an extraordinarily complex. But
awareness, though. Like, I think the...
Well, you can not vote for ScoMo, I guess. That's a start.
That's a great idea. Well, maybe. Like, honestly.
I don't know, but then people would argue, well, what are the Labor Party doing? You know, what is anyone doing? And, like, you know.
But that's politics, though. Do you know what I mean? But I think it's like, for example, it's the awareness, like having the conversations that nobody wants to have about, no, we understand that we have generations of like a leg up front in front of you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We understand. So then from there, it's like, okay, thank you for acknowledging that. I'm not saying that it's your fault. First of all, you were not born when your uncles were like, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And the same thing is I wasn't born when my aunties.
So along those lines, what's your thoughts on the Reconciliation Tribunal in mm-hmm. South Africa? Sorry, is that what it's called? Where they are talking to people who committed crimes under apartheid and they are kind of confessing to them.
I'm angry because... You know, when I studied apartheid, and I studied it here, and I wasn't even in South Africa. I studied it when I was in South Africa because, you know, that's what we learn.
Yeah.
But when I did an in-depth study and understanding, like, how how the Constitution got rewritten, how, you know, how everything, like, the Bill of Rights was written, the whole situation of the transition from apartheid to, like, freedom happened. And the frustrating thing was, like, we were so happy for freedom that we didn't understand that we didn't actually have any freedom. Do you understand what I mean? Mm. We were so happy to not have to live in a segregated world physically that we didn't understand that still underlyingly, economically, we're still segregated. And on top of that, the people who have done these horrendous hate crimes
yes.
are now coming and being, oh, we're all good.
So, the bottom line is that many did confess
mm-hmm.
to what they did. So
mm-hmm.
was that in any way healing to South Africa as a society? Or do you feel it was a bit sort of tokenistic if they weren't punished for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the same way that we would want justice, like through the Nazis, how the Nazis, when they got busted,
they got punished. Anyone they could find, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because of that, that doesn't necessarily like take away the trouble from the Jews and what they went through, but that recognition of
there was the sense that we will hunt them down
exactly.
and we will bring them to justice.
And we will find
those who were directly responsible for the termination of Jewish people. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
like you could point the finger at the SS, Gestapo, but
mm-hmm.
but they didn't point the finger at your foot soldier,
mm-hmm.
your German foot soldier.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't necessarily point the finger at every bureaucrat.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder maybe that was also a very hard thing to negotiate, that who actually was responsible.
Yeah, but it's crazy because it's like, who do you, how do you arrest somebody for something that's in their heart? Do you understand what I mean? Oh, okay. Like, how do you arrest, like, for example.
So it's more like an attitude.
That, yeah, it's more of a heart check, do you know? Yeah. Like, for example, how we say with the Nazis, like, the main people, like, the main authority heads were the ones who were, held accountable and, you know, put to, not put to shame, but like, you know, held accountable and justice was somewhat served. The heart of that person who's on top and the heart of the person who's a foot soldier, their intentions are the same.
Yeah.
The discrimination, the hate, the, you know, it's still the same. It's just that one has an authority where he can send other people to act on the same heart choice.
And therefore should have more responsibility.
Responsibility. But it doesn't change the fact that these people share the same mentality. Do you understand what I mean? Mm. So it's like, why, if you were able to go ahead and follow what the authority was saying to you, you should also follow the repercussions. They may not be the same as him because he has the authority over you, but you should also somehow...
You should not abdicate your responsibility.
Exactly.
You do have a...
Yes, it shouldn't be like, oh, sorry, I was told to do this. No, you were not... You were told to, yes, but not to a point where, like, you made a choice.
But people don't really think that way, do they?
Yeah.
They just follow orders and they abdicate their responsibility. And we all do to a lesser or greater extent. Because if we thought, like, otherwise, I mean, I've got this ethical shopping guide for supermarkets at home.
Okay.
But if I were to follow it, I'd be in the supermarket, like, for an entire day. Those chickpeas, were they grown organically, fair trade, and so on? I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that, but I'm just saying that it's a complex thing.
It is.
And most people... go, oh, bugger it, I'll just do what someone told me to do. Usually someone on the internet is mad or
that's
drunk.
That's true, yeah. Or like just venting.
So we just follow the loudest sparkling light that we follow.
That's why we need that light. Do you understand what I mean? That's why we need those conversations for people to be able to start. You know, like, for example, like Trevor Noah made a brilliant joke on his set, like, in South Africa, and he said, I don't understand where everybody thought, like, all the racists went when, like, apartheid and, like, it's like everybody was like, oh, you know what, let's put down our guns, it's been a great run, guys, we're good. Germany is like, no, the heart's intent is still there.
It's still there.
It's just that they don't have the power by law. So that's why even as generations pass, you can still feel the segregation between...
What's the solution?
The solution is like what Julius Malema said. It's understanding equality, but not equality like, you know, equality people think it's such a complex thing. And it's like, it's really not. It's really not that deep. It's like, you know, Julius was saying, like, I'll just use reference of South Africa. He was saying the white South Africans are not angry for anything. They're angry because they have to be equal to a black person. Because for so many generations, they've been up.
Yep, I understand that.
So now I think, the solution would be to create systems that open for everybody. But that's hard.
It's because it's an unlevel playing field. Because your white South African has had the advantage for
many years.
And they've got the education and they've got the capital and they've got the business.
And they've got their cousins.
And, you know, so they've got the connections and they're connected to a global market. Whereas you get some guy who's an African guy who's got best of intentions of the world.
But has no education.
But hasn't been educated. And so they would argue. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Zuma. Would argue, well, this is what happens. You know? Which, in a racist perspective, would be. Oh, this is what happens when black people are in control. But a more liberal would say, well, we need to redress that educational balance first. Like a liberal, meaning like a capitalist liberal who believes that the free market is the most sensible kind of system. Otherwise, we have communism, etc. Mugabe, etc. Mobutu Sese Seko, etc. As opposed to your Julius Nyerere, and your Kwame Nkrumah, and your more enlightened African leaders, they'll point to those other ones. But so that your white liberal, you know, would say, oh, well, let's. Slowly, like Lancaster House in Zimbabwe, make sure that we get equality in balanced with economic stability. Even though it is unequal, eventually it will work. How do we speed that up? I guess is my question.
How do we speed it up? We take the old people out of parliament. We keep, I don't even want to, 20%. 20% of the generation
who are entrenched within the corruption.
Yes. People who have been in power since freedom has come, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And we put people who are young, because you know how you're saying like the educational foothold of like, you know, white South Africans have like that whole generation of like, so it's like generations ahead. Yeah. But there are so many kids, so many African students, so many African people who are educated, but the opportunities are not given to them. Because why? Old people are busy warming up seats in parliament and giving kids, do you know what I mean? And giving their family and their cousins and their uncles who don't even have a degree, who don't even know anything about math, who don't know anything about the economy, who don't know anything about history itself, except for the history that they have experienced. But now they're so used to the comfort of, it'd rather be us because we know the struggle, you know? It'd rather not be you because you know the struggle. And after the struggle, you got happy because you got 2 cents of happiness and now you're leaving everybody else, you know?
It's animal farm.
Yeah, it is. Because like, you know, I was thinking, I was like, it's so crazy. Like in South Africa and in Australia, you can start working as a teenager from 14, right? And in South Africa, I think it started at 18. It starts at 18 because of the child labor laws of if you hire a child underneath 18, they're slaves. Of you're making them a slave. But then think about the fact that is when you go to 18 years old, right? 18, by the time you're 18, you go back and you go study. You're studying, maybe you do a degree for 4 to 5 years, let's say. Or you do a diploma that takes you 6 years or so, which they do take so long. By the time you graduate, now you're looking for a job at your local supermarket, at your local... But now the aunties who have never had the ability to work and have... or never had the ability for education are working at the supermarkets. They're the ones who are at the tills. They're the ones... So economically, the country is not stable enough for change. Do you understand what I mean? Yeah. Because a large demographic, which is the youth, is not... doing anything. Do you know what I mean? They're not given the power.
Yeah.
And because they're not given the power, the people in parliament are now saying, oh, we don't want to tell these ones to come up here. They don't even know what they're doing. Yeah. They've never even had a job in their day. They've never worked in their lives. But it's like, no, we've never worked in our lives because you never opened the opportunities for us as youth, you know?
Yeah.
Like for me, I already have a work ethic. I already know what it means to wake up and, you know, go and do this and clock in, clock out, clock. But my cousins don't have that. I have an auntie of mine who hasn't worked like ever.
And they need those opportunities.
And they need those opportunities.
Well, you've got to create the economic landscape whereby they have those opportunities.
Yeah, and also taking out all those old people out of parliament creates relevant conversations to now. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like the generation that we're trying to build next year, years from
looking
now,
forward.
Years looking forward for, because we're like, you know, it's annoying when people are like, the youth are the future, but you won't put us anywhere. You won't put us in parliament. You wanna keep telling us how we're useless, how we always get drunk and we always do this. But it's like, oh, if I don't have time, if I don't have anything to do with my time, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna be idle with that time.
Yeah.
And being idle with that time means I'm gonna drink, I'm gonna go to parties, I'm gonna just do anything to occupy my mind. And now I'm occupying. Crime rate is going up. Crime rate would go so much lower, so much lower if youth were working, because the majority of the people who are causing these crimes is the youth.
Yeah.
And the reason they're causing these crimes is because you have a grandmother who has been working and working and working in this man's house for like over the past 50 years, besides the fact that she's no longer a slave to him or no longer, you know, under his guard, she's still his slave because she's never had another job.
Because of the economic
landscape. Exactly. So now you grow up and she's been supporting you. She's been taking you to school. She's been clothing you. And now you grow up and she's sick. She's sick. She doesn't have medical aid, because apparently in South Africa, about 82 people of the population don't have medical aid. Doesn't have a stable house, doesn't have water, doesn't have anything, and she's dying. What are you gonna do? And you're applying for jobs, you're applying. If you see that there's a person there around the corner who has like $500 that you think they don't need, you're gonna go make sure that grandma can eat, grandma can go to hospital, do you know what I mean? And it's like, oh no, people think like the crime rate is intentional or it's out of problems. Like, no.
Would you say that South Africa is reasonably functional, though, as a nation? I mean, can we make comparisons? Is South Africa going down the way of, say, you know, Liberia? You know,
I don't feel like I feel like we're functional because we're the only country, you know, people in other African countries look at South Africa and they say, oh, what a great nation. Do you know what I mean? They look at us, they're like, oh, what a great nation. But then you come here as a South African and you see Australia and you compare to that and you're like, what a shit nation.
Because like, South Africa.
Yeah, like, because you understand what I mean? Yeah. Like, and it's little things. Like the other day
You got a better national anthem than us, though.
I mean, of course, Australians, oh, let us really, like, that's all we got.
We don't even sing it. We don't even know the words.
Exactly. I don't even. Then you curve with it. You know, our land. That's Australians for you.
It can be embarrassing.
That's very.
Well, I think, have we solved all of Sub-Saharan Africans' problems?
We're halfway there. We're halfway there.
we've admitted them.
Yeah. The real problem, honestly, is a matter of youth. Like, I honestly think we need so much more of youth in parliament.
Yeah.
You know, sure. Much. Like, we had a South Africa, I think the first 21-year-old was in parliament just recently. She's like the first person ever. And now they're talking like smack about her, you know? Oh, she's too young. She can't. And it's like, she's speaking sense.
Yeah. And they also are like the vanguard for other young people to look up to that and say, well, I can do it too. I mean, I think that's really important that you get that person in there.
But why is it one person? Just know what I mean. It's like, why we're in a position, we're no longer living in like the 50s where it's like, oh, that one black person and that's the big thing. It's like, no, open it up for like 40 people.
Yeah.
40 people, and make sure that those 40 people, even if they're in different parties, they don't necessarily have to be in one party, or they don't necessarily, they can even just be independents in the parliament. Just know what I mean?
But they've got the voice.
But they've got the voice, and they can speak about relevant things that other generations, like the older generations, won't think about. I mean, let's think about parliament. Like, last year in South Africa alone, they stole about 60 billion rand. The parliament, the people who are supposed to be sorting things out. And then after they did that, they got busted, right? They got busted for stealing that. And while there was an investigation, they still stole more money and took it offshore.
Well, they had to pay for their lawyers.
What lawyers? Because afterwards, the investigation went nowhere.
it's
the comfort.
It's a conundrum.
Yeah. It's the comfort. It's as if like the old generation is saying, oh, you know what? We marched, we strived, we did this for our kids and for our, so therefore this is my payment.
This
and
sense of of obligation.
Of obligation. Yes, like, oh, no,
the same thing with Mugabe and ZANU-PF and the old vanguard there that have taken over. And the current leader, who's pretty well just the same.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Did Mugabe, is he dead?
No, he's not dead.
I think he's still alive.
He's still, he's
looks
chilling.
Looks like he's made of plasticine.
He's chilling. He's just out here like creeping, but he's chilling.
But anyway, Ponso, it's been wonderful talking to you. I've learned so much.
You,
I hope the listeners have learned a lot too.
Thank you so much.
And we have our stage reading of Monrovia plus many other plays at Holden Street Theatre on the 17th and 18th of August, if I've got that right. Otherwise, I'll correct it in the next podcast.
I'm excited.
Ponso, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Matthew, or Matt, rather. Thank you.